Coming up on Philosophy Talk, Jewish philosophy.
Let's think about a variety of different religious and ethical traditions. Judaism, and one could say the same thing about Christianity and Islam, is really dealing with a kind of encounter between God and human beings.
Is Jewish philosophy more about Judaism or more about universal philosophical issues?
Judaism, it doesn't claim to provide an ethics for all people. And it doesn't make a universal claim that everybody ought to believe these things or everybody ought to live in a certain way or else they won't be saved.
Our guest is Paul Franks from the University of Toronto.
God is also learning something about morality from human experience. It wouldn't be possible for God to know without that human experience, because it requires the existence of a created world and finite human beings who are going to mess things up.
Jewish philosophy,
coming up on Philosophy Talk.
After the news.
Welcome to Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. We're coming to you from the studios of 91.7 KALW, Loco Innovative Public Radio for San Francisco.
Continuing conversations that begin at Philosopher's Corner on the Stanford campus.
And from that lovely oasis of thought, we migrate to this oasis of the air, and from the air to the internet via our blog, the blog.philosophytalk.org, where our motto is Cogito Ergo Blogo. I think therefore I blog. Go check it out.
And today, Ken, we're talking about Jewish philosophy, and I suppose there's a question of what we mean. If we just mean articles and books written by Jews, then we could discuss, say, Howard Wettstein and David Kaplan on reference.
Oh, well, or somebody more familiar under it, we could discuss Marx, who said that religion is the opiate of the masses. But, that, you know, that's not what we're talking about. Not philosophy written by Jews, but philosophy written by people who are deeply engaged with the philosophers who are deeply engaged with the Jewish religious tradition, with the Talmud and the Bible, and trying to articulate it, defend it, reconcile it with reason, that sort of thing.
Now, Jewish philosophy, like Christian philosophy and Islamic philosophy, in the sense you describe, flowers in the Middle Ages. The Muslim philosophers rediscover the works of Aristotle. This passes to the Jewish philosophers and then to the Christian philosophers. And I must say, Ken, if I were to go back in time and be a philosopher in that era, I would definitely choose to be a Jewish philosopher rather than a Christian philosopher.
Now, why would you say a thing like that? I mean, why? What's the basis for that choice?
Because the Christian philosophers have what we might call an apparent contradiction right in the middle of their theology, namely the Trinity, three in one in three, and all that. And the Jews are real monotheists, so they at least don't have that apparent contradiction well, to overcome.
Well, there is that, especially given the kind of Aristotelian background with which they're all working by the time we're talking about. Aristotelian substance is a kind of unity, right? But the Trinity is three persons, one substance. And he's like, how's that supposed to be? How's that go with the unity of substance and therefore the unity of God?
I mean,
but it's not as though Judaism is without problems in confronting in its philosophical.
Now, I just want to make it this guy. I don't mean that a really brilliant philosopher like Al Plantinga or Bob Adams might not prefer to go back and be a Christian philosopher so they could grapple with this seemingly impossible problem. But for me, I'd rather be a Jewish philosopher.
But it's not all roses.
No, it's not all roses. They still got Aristotle didn't believe in individual immortality. Aristotle's what people meant by reason at the time, and he believed in the finitude of space and he didn't believe in the finitude of space and time, which seems sort of implied by the opening books of the Bible.
Right. So if it's created, it wasn't lasting forever, it was not immortal, and no individual is immortal. So look, I mean, there's a lot to learn about Jewish philosophy.
Yeah, like you, Ken, I didn't learn much as an undergraduate, so we better learn a lot on this program.
And our roving philosophical reporter, Paula Stryker, also wanted to find out more, so she files this report.
Some people think the Greeks hold a monopoly on philosophy, but like the birds and the bees, everyone does it. So, what's Jewish philosophy?
Jewish philosophy, in general, is very much concerned with the Bible and the question of creation and the question of what kind of God is God.
Lior Batnitsky is associate professor of religion at Princeton University. When it comes to Jewish philosophers, the most famous by far is medieval rabbi Moses Maimonides. He thought a lot about the nature of God.
Maimonides was very concerned about the question of anthropomorphism in the Bible. There are many descriptions of God as if God is a human personality. God gets angry, God has all kinds of feelings, God loves the people. And for Maimonides, this was extremely disturbing. And he argued that all people had to understand that God couldn't be spoken about like you speak about a person. That's absolutely central.
Solomon ibn Gabarol, an 11th century Jewish philosopher who most people have never even heard of, had a large influence on Christian thinkers, including Thomas Aquinas.
His main argument was that you couldn't really separate spirit from matter. In a general sense, this idea really led to the separation between theology and philosophy, ultimately. This argument that you don't have to talk about God in transcendent terms, or you don't have to talk about reality in transcendent terms.
It was Jewish philosophers who carried the torch of Greek and Arab thought to Europe.
Solomon ibn Gabirol is the person who really is credited with bringing Islamic philosophy into Christian thought, not just into Jewish thought. Maimonides as well is very influenced by Muslim philosophers.
The connection between Jewish philosophers and the Islamic world, even into fairly modern times, seems surprising given today's headlines.
Almost all modern Jewish philosophers, with a couple of exceptions, argued that Judaism was much closer to Islam than it was to Christianity. In fact, when modern Jewish philosophers wanted to argue that Judaism was a rational religion, they compared Judaism to Islam. Not only that, but the study of Islam, the academic study of Islam, at least in Germany, was pioneered by Jewish thinkers.
One of the best-known modern Jewish philosophers was Martin Buber, who died in 1965. His big contribution to philosophy involves concepts called the I-thou and I-it relationships.
Basically, his idea is that we can understand people as objects or as subjects. When we understand them as objects, that's an I-it relationship. We understand other people in an instrumental way. We use them for something. But the more authentic way of being is in our relationship with other people, and he calls that the I-thou or the I-you relationship. And he claims that this is the relationship with God. In relation with other people, we experience our relationship to God.
We can't talk about modern Jewish philosophy without talking about the Holocaust. Immanuel Levinas, who died in 1995, tackled the Holocaust through a philosophical lens.
For him, the question is, after the Holocaust, how can philosophy talk about morality? I mean, he starts off his one of his main works, Totality and Infinity, with the question of, have we been duped by morality? And for Levinas, that's really the philosophical question, not just for Jews, but for everybody.
According to Budnitsky, the nature of God is central to Jewish philosophy.
I think that that question about God and God's relationship to the human being, in many ways, is this question of transcendence. What does transcendence mean philosophically? What does immanence mean philosophically? In that sense, I think that's a contribution of Jewish thought or Jewish philosophy to philosophy. Now, is it particularly Jewish, more so than Christian or, say, Islamic? I think the answer there, and this is the answer that lots of Jewish philosophers give, is, well, Judaism is the original.
For Philosophy Talk, I'm Polly Stryker.
Thanks, Polly, for that interesting and educational piece on Jewish philosophy. I'm John Perry. With me is Ken Taylor.
We're joined by Paul Franks. He's professor of philosophy at the University of Toronto, author of many things, but he's the particularly pertinent for our topic today. He's a translator and commentator on the philosophical and theological writings of Franz Rosenzweig. Paul, welcome to Philosophy Talk.
Hi, Ken. Hi, John. Good to be here.
Paul, John Perry here. I've got a question for you. In the Middle Ages, there was a great flowering of religious philosophy, Islam, Judaism, and Christianity. All dealt with similar problems, especially faith, revelation, and reason. Can you give us a sense of what's distinctive about the approach of the great Jewish philosophers?
Well, I would say that, for one thing, which has already been mentioned, the conflict between reason and faith is understood in a slightly different way than it typically than the form it typically takes within Christian philosophy, because there are no Jewish doctrines or dogmas that appear to actually conflict with reason. They may not be required by reason, but there's no obvious conflict of the kind that there would at least seem to be for, say, the Christian doctrine of incarnation and also the Trinity. At the same time, there's something else peculiar about Judaism, which is that a lot of the content of Jewish faith, although not all of it, is particularistic.
Right.
It concerns the specific experience and history of the Jewish people. And it doesn't make a universal claim that everybody ought to believe these things or everybody ought to live in a certain way or else they won't be saved.
But the God of the Jewish people is, by his own claim, everybody's God, right?
That's right.
And everybody is in some kind of relationship to him. And so why is that? I mean, it's kind of weird. Right? Are the rest of us, you know, just not in the correct moral relationship to God, and so the law is not addressed to us because we're lost anyway or something like that?
No, I think that it would be hard to find any Jewish philosophers who say anything quite like that. There's got to be, as you say, both a universalistic dimension of Jewish philosophy and a particularistic dimension. So there is some way in which, yeah, God is the creator of the world, and from a Jewish point of view, God has a covenant with all of humanity. Before God has any specific covenant with Abraham and his descendants and so on. One standard way of looking at that is to say that the divine covenant with Noah after the flood places certain constraints on, normative constraints on human behavior and human belief, a recognition of one God, setting up a system of justice, having prohibitions on incest, that sort of thing. But those are very general. And there are lots, you know, indefinitely many different ways in which different human societies can, in fact, fulfill those conditions.
Let me ask you another question. You talked about the particularistic character of many Jewish religious doctrines or edicts or prohibitions. But you know, another word for particularistic is random. Right? Arbitrary. Now, you know, I mean, you might wonder, you say Jewish philosophers don't have the same challenge. They don't have to reconcile this apparently illogical trinity with their broader philosophical outlook. But what about a God who gives you these random commandments that don't seem, you know, I mean...
Let me be a little more specific here. Take Maimonides, of whom I have, let us say, an extremely superficial knowledge. But he has this very abstract conception of God. You can't really say anything positive about God. He's kind of got these similar ideas to other philosophers of other faiths that you can only characterize him negatively and so forth. And yet, at the same time, there's all these specific commandments. I mean, there's circumcision, there's Ten Commandments, there's the chosen people, there's all this stuff. How can you get that very abstract conception of God that comes out of the Middle Ages for everybody, and these very particularistic things, how can those be reconciled?
Yeah, and that's a big question for classical Jewish philosophy, and explaining the particularities of the commandments is one of the major projects of Maimonides, among other people in that period. What Maimonides does, which has been controversial, is to give an interpretation that is in part symbolic and in part historical. So there are going to be some commandments whose role in one's life is symbolic. They symbolize certain truths that one is supposed to bear in mind. Others are historical, so they're explained in terms of the practices of Israelites beforehand, say pagan practices that one wants to overcome. So there are certain things one doesn't do precisely because pagans did them.
Right.
Not everybody has liked that approach, and they've tried to find some sort of intrinsic significance to the commandments instead.
Yeah, I've been reading Guide to the Perplexed, and I do find it kind of perplexing because he says, tell me if I've got this roughly right. A lot of confusion, a lot of perplexity arises from taking certain words too literally, and that you have to realize that a lot of it is simile and metaphor. And if you understand the simile and metaphor right, your perplexity kind of goes away or is lessened. Is that right?
Yes, Maimonides' Guide is in the first place a work of biblical interpretation, and it's coming out of a very old tradition within Judaism of non-literal or figurative interpretation of problematic passages. And in many ways, that goes back at least as far as the 3rd century BCE, which is the time of at least the beginning of the translation of the Bible into Greek, the Septuagint, in ancient Egypt, where there's already an exchange between, maybe a legendary exchange, but it's recorded, between the king who ordered the translation of the Bible into Greek and a Jewish philosopher named Aristobulus. And the king says, well, you know, how can you say all these things about God that God stretched out his hand and so on. How could God have a hand? And this is a problem that had already arisen within the Greek tradition for understanding Greek myth. And Aristobulus' answer, kind of like the Stoics and other Greek philosophers of the time, is we have to interpret those passages non-literally.
Well, we're going to take you up on that a little bit more after the break. You're listening to Philosophy Talk. Our subject today is Jewish philosophy. Our guest is Paul Franks from the University of Toronto.
We've been talking about how Jewish philosophers face certain special problems and had maybe certain special advantages in the classical period on issues of faith and reason. In the next segment, we'll talk about conceptions of God.
Faith, reason, and your calls and emails when Philosophy Talk continues.
Robert Zimmerman, a.k.a. Bob Dylan, revisiting his bar mitzvah lessons with Tuckin' Havana Nigila Blues. This is Philosophy Talk, and I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Our topic today, Jewish philosophy. What are your thoughts? Have you ever tried to reconcile faith and reason? Join the conversation.
The number is 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. Outside the Bay Area, call toll-free at 1-800-525-9917. You can also email us at comments@philosophytalk.org.
Our guest is Paul Franks from the University of Toronto. So, Paul, I want to go take you back to the kind of the rationality of Judaism and your claim that there's kind of less of a challenge. At least there are certain challenges missing from Jewish theology that are present for Christian theology. But, you know, here's the thing. Yahweh is, I don't know if I can use this word on the radio, is a bastard. The Christian God is a loving God who gave himself. God became flesh, you know, sacrifice. But Yahweh takes the Jewish folks on this amazing journey, you know, reduces them to the remnant, brings them out of captivity, lets them be captured, and all the while promising some future Messiah. But, I mean, that God sounds like such a bastard. I mean, when Jewish philosophers start thinking about God in philosophical terms, how do they deal with that?
Well, I think that there's really a new approach to Jewish philosophy that has developed in the last 100 years or so, which has been it promises to shed light on this whole topic. I mentioned before that there's an old debate that goes all the way back to the 3rd century BC about bringing essentially Greek problems about religion and about religious language into a Jewish context. And a lot of what Maimonides does and other classical thinkers within Jewish philosophy can be seen within that framework. But there's always been a sort of a resistance to that by some Jewish thinkers, and I think that's really come to the forefront in the last 100 years when Jewish philosophy itself has started thinking a bit differently.
Explain this tension that you're talking about, though, so that our listeners can have a sense of why they would reject that old Greekified approach. Explain that tension a bit.
It's a question in the first place of translation, whether the Greek terms, like anthropomorphism, right, the problem of thinking about God in human terms, which has a problem that was raised by the Greeks before it was raised by Jews or Christians or Muslims, whether that really applies in the right way, in the same way, to the Bible and to other Jewish traditions. So one important distinction to make, I think, is that whereas Greek religion really claims to provide us with a sort of discourse by human beings about God or about gods, Judaism, and one could say the same thing about Christianity and Islam, is really dealing with revelation. So it's really a kind of encounter between God and human beings.
So this reminds me of the one Jewish philosopher I did read as an undergraduate, Martin Buber.
Yes.
So he's a leader in this movement?
Yes, indeed. Along with Franz Rosenzweig and later on, I would say, Immanuel Levinas more recently. Now, among other things, thinking of God as someone with whom one has an encounter, thinking of God as part of this very personal relationship that develops throughout Jewish history, can shed light on the question that was raised before about God's treatment of the Jews and other peoples in the Bible. Because one thing that you see in the Bible is a very personal kind of engagement. Already Abraham, at the time when God is saying he's going to destroy the cities of Sodom and Gomorrah, Abraham not only talks back to God, but he actually challenges God morally.
Right.
So one thing that Maimonides' conception of God is this extremely abstract thing, probably provable by the ontological argument or something, and Martin Buber's conception of God as this other with whom one enters into relationship, is they both seem to require God to exist. And, you know, in a way, it might be easier to argue for the existence of Maimonides' God than Martin Buber's God. I mean, if he's supposed to be the God that's recounted in the old, in what Christians call the Old Testament, but most Jews I know, frankly, ones who obey all the religious traditions and take their Jewish heritage very seriously, don't really seem to believe in God. So is belief in God really a part of contemporary Jewish thought?
I think it surely is. But what belief in God usually means to Jews may be a little bit different than what it means, say, within Christianity. And after all, even though not all philosophers of religion are Christian today, of course, but still, Christianity has shaped the way in which philosophy of religion is done. So I would say that belief in, from a Christian point of view, tends to take the form of the question about whether one has reason for certain beliefs with certain propositional contents, beliefs that such and such is the case,
right,
and so on. That isn't usually the form that belief takes within Judaism. I would say, and this is following the more recent line that I mentioned, Rosenzweig, Buber, Levinas, and so on, thinking about relationship with God as a personal relationship, I would say that belief or faith within Judaism is better understood as something like the sort of trust that develops within a personal relationship. That also provides you with reasons for belief, but reasons that have, if I can borrow one of John's terms, an essentially indexical dimension, so that they essentially involve the I and the thou, as Buber put it, the people involved.
I'm really happy to have my terminology put into a theological setting. I'm sitting here beaming, what? So you may continue.
Okay. So I think the question about proof of existence is going to take a different form once it's put in that way, and it's not going to take the form of a question about proof of some sort of generally available fact that could be stated in entirely impersonal or third-personal terms.
I understand. Reading Maimonides, he says this strange thing, which I found difficult to understand, that none of us stand in any relation to God, because that would give God relational attributes or something, and God has no attributes. And I thought, what the devil is he talking about? But this kind of personal conception, it makes more sense. It does make relatedness to God a kind of fundamental feature of us and a fundamental feature of God, and it seems more consistent with actually the sacred text.
Right. One of the incredible things about Jewish philosophy is that Maimonides is, on the one hand, an extremely radical thinker. I mean, there are lots of Jewish philosophers who don't go anywhere near as far as he does. At the same time, he is the canonical thinker, if anybody is. And that's largely not because of the Guide of the Perplexed, but because of his other major work, which is the first and perhaps the only real exhaustive code of Jewish law.
So, Paul, let me try out a kind of a wild idea here, but I joked at the beginning of the program about, well, can we talk about Kaplan and Kripke and Wettstein and these other great Jewish philosophers of our contemporary age? And Ken's answer was no. But actually, when we get to Martin Buber and I and thou, you might say, look, this conception is that you have this relationship with this being, and that's God, and you know he's there. And then there's the question of whether he fits these descriptions given to us by the Bible, but that's not the essential question. So you might forge a link between Rosenzweig and Buber on the one hand and Kaplan and Kripke on the other. What do you think of that?
Yeah, indeed. I think one might. I mean, that still would not lead me to want to speak of everything that, say, Kaplan and Wettstein have written as Jewish philosophy. I don't think that Jewish philosophy is everything that's written by Jews. Some of what Harry Wettstein writes is Jewish philosophy, of course.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're discussing Jewish philosophy. You can join our discussion by calling 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. And Joanne in San Francisco is on the line. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Joanne. What's your comment or question?
Oh, good morning. Thank you. You know, just last night I was having a talk with a friend, and he's always so surprised that I don't have a wonder of, is this all there is, and kind of searching and all of that. And I grew up completely without any concept of God or religion. We celebrated holidays, actually both Jewish and Christian, but as family holidays. I really never saw any difference between Christmas, Easter, Passover, 4th of July, or Chinese New Year. And for me, the idea of God is, I don't know, it's as
weird as like a green Martian walking through the door. I just have no, it's not, you know, it's a completely unknown thing. Anyway, thank you very much.
Thanks for the comment.
Thanks for the comment, Joanne. Steve in San Francisco is on the line. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Steve.
Hi. First of all, I'd like to say thank you for moving to Sunday mornings. It's much easier to hear your program, and it's a good time to listen.
Well, thanks, Steve. We were hoping that would be the case. But what's your comment or question?
I'm someone who's thought about the Trinity a little bit, and I when you brought it up, I had this thought that I would like to get some critical response to, which is the chemical formula for water is H2O, the chemical formula for ice is H2O, and the chemical formula for steam is H2O. So you've got three persons in one substance. So why is it so hard?
Well, if you could take that line, it wouldn't be so hard. Three descriptions, one being. Three senses, one referent, we might put in the Frege philosophy of language terms. However, the Trinity, as I understand it, and I'm no great expert, demands a little more than that. It's not three descriptions of one being. It's three beings that are somehow one. Now, maybe Paul can shed a little light on this, or Ken with his Notre Dame education.
Well, Paul, we invited you here as an expert on Jewish philosophy, but if you want to weigh in on the Trinity.
I'm sorry to bring it up. It was the only opportunity I've had, and I was afraid I was trivializing it, that is, the Trinity, but I thought at least it's an example of three things being one thing, but maybe...
Yeah, that's three different aspects, right, but not three separate. But Paul, what do you think?
Well, I think that it's true that that is underestimating the difficulties of the Trinity from a Christian point of view, that we're talking there somehow about three different beings in one. And although I don't claim expertise about this, I did used to teach at Notre Dame, so some experience of this. And it seems to me that there are lots and lots of different formulas about how exactly to express the nature of the divine Trinity. But if it was only a matter of three different descriptions, then Jews and others would not have had a problem with Trinitarianism.
But Steve, you didn't really trivialize it. If you lived back at Augustine's time, you would have been one of the major contenders. And until Augustine got you excommunicated or whatever, your theory would have been considered very plausible.
Thanks, Steve. Thanks for the call. You can join our discussion by calling 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. But, Paul, I want to go back to the rationality and the reconciling faith and reason with God. I mean, is it easier? If I think of God as this other, that's Buber and Levinas, this other, this transcendental other with whom I am in some kind of ethically tinged relationship. I guess it's the source of ethics or something like that.
Can you keep looking at me when you say the other?
But since he's kind of outside, I mean, if he's outside of space and time, I mean, what does that mean that he's present to me as this? What does that mean exactly? Isn't that as boggling as anything else?
Well, I think that for that reason, what we find in more recent Jewish philosophy, especially someone like Rosenzweig's Star of Redemption, is an attempt to really rethink a great deal of what traditional Jewish philosophers would have said. For example, speaking of God as outside space and time, if that's something that's going to get in the way of what for Rosenzweig would be the primary given of religious experience, which is the encounter with God, then it can't be a doctrine of faith in any way.
So how does Rosenzweig think of it then? If he's not outside space and time, is he like around the corner?
Rosenzweig tries to think of God as eternal, where eternity is not something that is totally opposed to space and time, but is going to have its own modes of temporality, let's say, that are especially characteristic of God and of relationships to God.
But you said, I don't understand that exactly. I don't know if you want to try to explain it to me more fully, but if he's not outside of space and time, and he's more kind of eminent, and I can be related to him, then there are like deep challenges. Why does he let things go so badly? You know, a transcendent God that's outside of space and time has a view of the whole, and it's like when Job goes up there and says, "What's going on, God?" He says, "Where were you when I created the universe? Buzz off, buddy." But this God that's closer, why does he let things go so badly? You know, why is there so much evil? Why did the Holocaust happen if he's so there and so with me?
Right. And of course, that's been a huge question for very recent Jewish philosophy as well, dealing with the Holocaust and with the whole problem of evil in general. So what I would say is this, from the point of view of Jewish philosophy, there has to be some dimension of transcendence to God. There also has to be some sort of immanence. The only person who's probably gone for immanence completely is Spinoza, but that also leads him to reject Judaism itself as any sort of continuing tradition. So if you're trying to reconcile some kind of transcendence and some kind of immanence, then there are a whole variety of ways to go. Perhaps the most radical way is something that I suggested before, which is symbolized by Abraham's moral argument with God, which is that God is also learning something about morality from human experience. That it wouldn't be possible, as it were, for God to know without that human experience, because it requires the existence of a created world and finite human beings who are going to mess things up.
So within Christianity, broadly conceived, there's something rather similar to what you're describing, and that's Mormonism. The Mormons see a finite God, therefore less problems with the problem of evil, definitely in space and time. I don't know if they think he can learn from human experience or not, but do you see any connection between contemporary Judaism and the Mormon movement, which also thinks that Christianity kind of got off the rails with Augustine and trying to bring Platonic philosophy into it, or is that just off base?
Well, I think there's some connection there, although, you know, I don't claim any great knowledge of Mormonism, but I was out earlier in the year at Brigham Young giving some lectures. I had some opportunity to talk to people, and it seemed to me that some of the basic ideas of Mormonism, like the one that you mentioned, God as actually developing, that has its own roots, of course, within a certain usually subterranean, often mystical tradition. The Mormons are getting it from Christian mystical tradition, but it's also there in Jewish mystical tradition too, especially in Kabbalah, which is, of course, getting a certain amount of popularity or notoriety these days.
From Madonna.
Exactly. Yeah. Yes.
Well, this is fascinating. I'm still not sure this makes it all rational or comforts me to the evil in the world and helps me be reconciled if I'm Jewish and religious to the Holocaust, but we'll ask you more about that in a little bit. You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're discussing Jewish philosophy with Paul Franks from the University of Toronto.
We've been talking about Jewish conceptions of God. In the next segment, we're going to look at how Jewish philosophers have treated the relation between religion and ethics.
Religion, ethics, plus more of your calls and emails when Philosophy Talk continues.
The Melodians, taking a line from the Book of Psalms and the Rivers of Babylon. I'm John Perry, and this is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Ken Taylor. We're talking about Jewish philosophy.
We're all familiar with the Ten Commandments, just one bit of morality and religion we owe to Judaism. How do you conceive of the relation between your religious beliefs, whatever they may be or not be, and what you take to be your duty, what you take to be right and wrong?
Join us by calling 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134.
Outside the Bay Area, you can call toll-free 1-800-525-9917. And you can email us comments at philosophytalk.org.
Our guest is Paul Franks from the University of Toronto. We've been a couple of callers been waiting for a while. Merle in Berkeley's on the line. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Merle.
Yes, I wanted to ask why you consider monotheism superior to polytheism.
You're not asking me that personally, because I consider theism inferior to all forms of non-theism. But, Paul, are there any reasons to consider monotheism philosophically superior to polytheism?
Well, I think there's a whole series of traditional proofs that try to show that if there is a God, then there has to be one God.
So, well, you wanted to help Merle understand this a little bit more?
Yeah, I would like to.
She's a little puzzled.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, if God is unlimited, then if there's another God, that's a problem. So as soon as you get into this medieval thing of God being all perfect, which implies unlimited, then you're going to have a lot of trouble having more than one of them.
What do you think about that, Paul?
Yeah, that's the fundamental sort of schema for lots of different proofs. Of course, as you say, that depends on the adopting a basically philosophical approach to God as being an infinite being.
Now, you know, in my own view, I kind of go for polytheism. That is, I take theism to be, should we worship anything? And I take the polytheism to be the answer, yes, there's a number of things we should worship. I'm all for that. I think we should worship the sun. I think we should worship Earth. I think we should worship luck.
Yeah. You know. But wait, let's go back a step. Merle, thanks for the question. Let's go back a step, Paul. So yes. If once we get this more immanent God, right? I mean, Judaism is a monotheistic religion. But once we get this more immanent God who can learn from human experience, right?
Yes.
Learn from this kind of experiment he does on creation. Now, why should we think there's only one of them? I mean, the argument for thinking there's one of them is that God's the sum of all perfections.
Well, there's a middle position, which is there's only one God, but he's not unlimited. That's the Augustine's Manichaeism.
Right, but why is there only one? once you start stripping God of infinite knowledge, infinite wisdom. You know?
Yeah, indeed. That's a great question. And, I think that a lot of recent Jewish philosophy, which has taken this other approach, has really not addressed it. It hasn't seen the need to, really, because it's situated within the context of a certain kind of experience. But it's a perfectly reasonable question. What I would say is something like this. Let's think about a variety of different religious and ethical traditions, one of which is Judaism. Commitment to one God would be something like commitment to the possibility of some sort of translation and communication between people who are living with those different traditions.
Right. Stephanie in San Francisco is on the line. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Stephanie.
Hi. I was growing up. I was a Canterbury as an Episcopalian acolyte, and I remember a pointed talk with my father driving back from Monterey and him telling me how the Passion of the Christ is how it really happened, which is definitely not my philosophy. But I actually just kind of look at God as the capacity to do good within people. I don't really assign it to the Trinity or whether there's a Trinity or not Trinity, but just a capacity to do good, I guess.
Well, okay, Stephanie, thanks. Thanks for that question, comment. Paul, you had any response to that?
Well, I think certainly within the Jewish tradition, there is a longstanding idea of human being created in the image of God and of associating the human capacity for ethics with that divine image as well.
Let me talk about ethics and Judaism. I mean, us post-Kantian folks, at least some post-Kantian folks like me, tend to think of ethics as a kind of system of universal requirements, binding on all rational beings as such, right? Stuff that it's your duty to do independently of who you are, what you want. Right. I mean, but Judaism has this great particularity, going back to the particularity. I mean, how do we think about the universal commandments addressed to everybody of ethics from a Jewish perspective?
Let me just interject there with a comment from we got by email from Ron in Boynton Beach, Florida. And he talks about the Maimonides, very abstract conception of God. And he says, why are such a God's wishes worth following? So that's the same question in a different way.
So, Paul, help us.
Okay. All right. I think there are fundamentally two different sorts of approach to the question of the particularity of Judaism on the one hand and the universality of ethics on the other. One, coming back to something I mentioned before, is the idea that Judaism has a universalistic dimension and also a particularistic dimension. There are going to be some very loosely defined constraints which are universalistic in their content. And from that point of view, say what Maimonides says about ethics in his 8 chapters is a variation of Aristotelian ethics. And in general, Jewish ethics is going to be just, you know, maybe only slightly different or not even that different at all from what other people have to say about ethics. And there's no distinctive Jewish contribution to it. But there's a more recent contribution, which I think is quite exciting and different. And that really has to do with the work of Levinas, the originally Lithuanian, later French Jewish philosopher. His thought is something like this. Judaism, it doesn't claim to provide an ethics for all people, but it provides something like a model of what ethics should be for all people. And the model goes something like this, that it has to do fundamentally with the encounter, an encounter with the other, which gives rise to a kind of normativity that has a certain sanctity to it, to right. an inviolability, and that then can that can be associated with particular ethical traditions that are then open to open-ended interpretation and discussion.
That and that other can either be God, the ultimate other, or just the other person I encounter as a being, as I understand Levinas, who somehow obligates me just in his. In his or her presence or something like that.
Exactly. It's the other human being, but understood as bearing the image of the divine.
Right. Well, you know, I wish we could dig into this more, but we've gotten to the end of our time with you, and this often happens. We just scratched the surface. We'll have to have you back sometime. How would that be?
That would be great.
Thanks for joining us, Paul.
Well, thanks a lot for having me on the show.
Our guest has been Paul Franks, a professor of philosophy at the University of Toronto, author of many things, but particularly relevant to today's topic. He's translator and commentator on the philosophical and theological writings of Franz Rosenzweig.
We also want to thank all the callers we didn't get a chance to talk to and the emailers whose email we didn't get a chance to read. We had a lot of good input today, and we thank you very much.
Thanks for joining us on our first Sunday morning, too, folks. It's been a lot of fun. So, John, are you less darkened? Are you enlightened here?
Yes, I learned a lot about Jewish philosophy, which is partly because our show has the virtue of
making you read stuff.
making me read stuff beforehand, and we had a very good guest, and I was starting with a base of a true ignorance. You know, I still think if I went back in time and was a philosopher in the Middle Ages, I would rather be defending Jewish philosophy and trying to reconcile it with Aristotle than Christian philosophy. But on a whole, I'm pretty happy that I'm a 21st century more or less secular philosopher.
Well, you know, I don't know. I mean, the medieval Christians and Jewish philosophers, I think as Paul told us something deep, they were really deeply influenced by Greek tradition, which puts God as this Aristotelian abstractum at the foundation of the universe, and then you wonder how you can have personal encounters with it, how he can be interactive in history. If you start with the kind of givens of the religious tradition, it's more like God is there interacting with us. Mm-hmm. We got to have some relationship with us. I don't think the Greeks provide you much machinery for thinking about that. So it's probably better to be alive and thinking about this stuff now.
Well, you know, the Mormons or the Hasidic Jews, they may have a point. Maybe philosophy, which was supposed to help reconcile religion and Aristotle really screwed things up.
Yeah. But you know what? This conversation continues on our blog, theblog.philosophytalk.org, where our motto is Cogito Ergo Blogo, I think, therefore I blog.
And you can download podcasts of our program from our website as well.
John, you know, I'm really feeling anxious. My heart is pounding. It's just pounding. I need to relax.
That's not your heart pounding. That's drumming, and it can only mean one thing.
I bet you it's time for a conundrum.
Exactly right, and we've got somebody on a phone.
Hey, welcome to Philosophy Talk, Liz.
Thank you.
Where are you from, Liz?
Hillsboro, Oregon.
Oh, terrific. Is that near Portland?
It's very near Portland, just a little bit to the west.
Terrific.
Well, what do you do up there in Hillsboro, Oregon?
Well, I'm retired, which means I have a certain amount of time to browse around in a Goodwill store. Mm. And the other day, I found an unused book called Italian Fairy Tales. And I picked it up because I've got two nieces, and they've got an Italian grandmother on the other side of the family, so it seemed very appropriate. But then I read it at home, and I'm not going to give it to them. It contains a few really strange racial images, which I did not expect to find in a book that on the copyright page said it was published in 1999.
Oh, my goodness.
But then I'm thinking, what do I want to do with it? Now, normally, if I don't want the book, I'll just give it back to Goodwill. But I don't think I want other people's kids to read this either. Now, I could just recycle the pages and send the cover to the landfill, but I find I've got an emotional reluctance to destroy a book, even a book I don't like. It sort of feels like book burning.
Well, you know, the reason it feels like book burning, Liz, seems to me it would be book burning, and I'm with you. Don't burn books. That went out with Hitler, you know.
Yeah, no, I'm totally disagreement. Book burning has the connotation of the kind of thing that the Nazis did or various other censors, would-be censors, and you know, you're destroying a book to destroy the ideas so that they don't circulate.
Isn't that your idea, Liz? No. It's not just that you want to recycle this old weather-beaten book that you don't no longer, you know, have space for. You want to exterminate the ideas in this book.
Yeah, I've got to admit that's true.
Well, but I want to make a distinction here, and maybe you and Ken are right about what you intend to do, but I'm not convinced. There's a difference between being part of something and not feeling you ought to interfere with something. So there's a lot of books out there that I totally disapprove of. There's lots of books that are very anti-analytical philosophy. There's books that make fun of Nebraska.
Great sellers, those.
Now, there's a lot of books that I intellectually feel the world would probably be better off without, but because I think, freedom of expression, all that stuff, if I had a button I could push that would eliminate every copy of those books from the world, I wouldn't do it. I wouldn't even do that with Mein Kampf. On the other hand, if I have a copy of such a book, right, and anything I do with it is going to mean that I have actually played a role in someone else being exposed to those ideas, maybe someone who's very impressionable or young, then why should I involve myself in this?
That's
different.
I agree with you. I agree with your distinction. Right, kind of like making happen and letting be or something like that.
Along those lines.
I agree with that. It's an important distinction, and one wants clean hands. But the idea that you find a book offensive and therefore you want to exterminate it and keep it away from the rest of the world, I might just set it on my shelf.
Okay.
In a corner.
And let me try this out. Okay, so here's a series of cases. Okay, you're going to the supermarket and somebody hands you a flyer. And it's a flyer from the Ku Klux Klan, and it says, we're going to have a racist meeting and burn some images of black people this evening. Now, what do you do with that?
Wad it up
and throw it in the trash.
Yeah, throw it away.
No feelings of guilt.
In a disgusted fashion.
In a disgusted fashion.
I'd display to the person who handed it to me my disgust and say, how dare you?
Okay, so now, second case, instead of handing you a flyer, they hand you a little book. Right, that not only announces the meeting, but, has a lot of other racist stuff in it, too. What are you going to do with the book?
I'd probably throw it away.
Okay.
In just the same way. But that's a different act, because there I'm communicating to them my disgust. That's an interpersonal transaction that's taking place.
Well, but there's three things. You might feel it'd be better off if this book were exterminated, but you yourself, because you're committed to freedom of the press, if you could push a button and exterminate the book, you probably wouldn't do it.
Right.
But the particular copy that you've got, like the particular copy that Liz has, why shouldn't you burn it? It's just an association of this act it's irrational.
No, wait a minute, baby. Maybe she might throw it away or recycle it. But again, burn it, and look at the expressive character of recycling it and burning it. Burning it is an act of, I don't know, it's a different pragmatic. Suppose Liz did a little ceremony and said, okay, I'm going to burn this book symbolically for all humankind. Because that's what she's doing, is the idea of Liz acting under the aspect of exterminating this idea. That's what bothers me. Not discarding the particular copy. Because I said, copies get wear-worn and all that, and you throw them away, you recycle them. Liz, what do you make of what? I mean, what do you, John and I are all over the place here. What are you thinking?
Well, you've made me think about the difference between the book itself and a particular copy of the book. And the ideas in the book. That's something I hadn't thought of.
So you might feel more comfortable burning the copy, what we sometimes call the token, but letting the type.
I'm less reluctant to destroy the copy, but now you've made me think that the book itself, I mean, it's got some historical value.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Maybe when they're in college, I say, 100 years ago, people took this kind of thing for granted.
Right.
Well, Ken and I have discussed Huckleberry Finn many times. I mean, I think it's a great novel, maybe the best American novel, but it's a very difficult book to sit down and read to your 9-year-old.
Yeah, definitely.
You have to do lots of explaining.
Okay, well, I hope we've helped you think about this and had some fun together.
Oh, yes, very much.
Okay, thanks for calling.
Thank you.
If you have a philosophical problem or quandary that's affecting your work or your play or keeping you awake at night, John and I would be happy to lend an ear and maybe give you some sound advice.
Go to the Philosophy Talk website and poke the conundrums button with your mouse, or just send an email to conundrums@philosophytalk.org. Philosophy Talk is a presentation of Ben Manila Productions and the trustees of Leland Stanford Junior University, copyright 2006.
Our executive producer is David Demarest.
Special thanks to Devin Strolovich, Neil Van Leeuwen, Ben Temption, and Mark Stone. Our senior consulting producer is Gordon Earle.
Support for Philosophy Talk comes from various groups at Stanford University.
Also from the Friends of Philosophy Talk and the members of KALW Local Public Radio, San Francisco, where our program originates.
The views expressed or misexpressed in this program do not necessarily represent the opinions of Stanford University or of our other funders.
The conversation continues on our website, www.philosophytalk.org. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Thank you for listening.
And thank you for thinking.